The impeachment trial starts tomorrow. We've already heard many of the arguments.
The president has argued that the call was perfect, his actions were perfect, every way this played out was perfect. And obviously many of us disagree with that. I disagreed with it in my testimony.
For the U.S. diplomatic service, an impeachment rooted in foreign policy makes for difficult days.
There's a true crisis at the State Department, and we need Republicans and Democrats to work together to build it back up.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, charges of corruption and nepotism on a billion-dollar scale.
You cannot just say, because you're someone's child, you're immediately guilty.
But that's exactly what many people in Angola believe. Plus 3D-printed houses from the ground up in Mexico. Those stories and more today on The World. Tomorrow, as you know, the impeachment of Donald Trump moves to the U.S. Senate. One of the Democratic impeachment managers, Adam Schiff, has tried to capture the gravity of what's at stake for the country.
President Trump acted in a manner contrary to his trust as president and subversive of constitutional government, to the great prejudice of the cause of law and justice, and to the manifest injury of the people of the United States.
The White House wants a swift conclusion to what Trump has called a hoax. Let's begin with something unprecedented in this impeachment. Trump's troubles are rooted in U.S. foreign policy and a rogue approach to diplomacy, specifically about Trump pressuring Ukraine's president for an investigation into Joe Biden and his son in exchange for U.S. military assistance. Impeachment and diplomacy have morphed into a single conversation. Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He served as ambassador to Greece during the Clinton impeachment trial in 1999. We should also point out that Nick is an unpaid advisor to the Joe Biden campaign. The State Department has been thrown into this weird situation here during this impeachment process. And while U.S. diplomacy is going to carry on as best it can, it's hard to see this is just business as usual. How is the State Department managing to function these days?
This is a very tough time for the State Department. Not only did President Trump try to cut the budget by one-third and one-quarter in the last two fiscal years, you saw back in October during the House impeachment inquiry, five Foreign Service officers called to testify. They were all told by the State Department leadership, don't testify in the White House. They all showed up and they all said the subpoena was more important. Their constitutional obligation to Congress was more important. And as a Foreign Service officer myself, now retired, I just felt proud of them. And I think it was a defining moment for this generation of Foreign Service officers that they did fulfill that mandate.
We're talking about people like former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch to Ukraine and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. What kind of support were they getting from State Department colleagues? Were you kind of privy to any of that?
Well, I think the rank and file of the State Department was very supportive of Ambassador Yovanovitch, Ambassador Bill Taylor, George Kent, who all testified. I think most people felt it was their responsibility to do so. They were not assisted in any way by White House lawyers or State Department lawyers. They were not given access to some of their records. I thought it was courage personified, almost a profile in courage. Ambassador Yovanovitch, of course, is back in the news, Marco, because the Lev Parnas revelations.
Right.
An associate of Rudy Giuliani who said he was representing the president of the United States had a conversation with another American that they would put Masha Yovanovitch, the ambassador of the United States to Ukraine, under surveillance in Kiev. I can't remember a single episode like this in the history of the United States. And the fact that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, did not stand up for 3 days last week and support her, I thought was a failure of leadership.
Pretty stunning. So as you said, Nick, even before this impeachment process started, the State Department had been facing budget cuts, staff cuts. How would you say U.S. diplomacy writ large has been kind of rattled and reshaped by this impeachment process?
Well, this impeachment trial of President Trump that begins this week is different than the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson, which was over whether or not he had the right under the law to fire the Secretary of War, or the impeachment trial of President Clinton. Did he lie under oath? This is a foreign policy issue. This goes to the heart of what the United States is all about, trying to help an independent nation which has been besieged by and now invaded by Russia to survive. That's a vital issue for the United States. A lot's at stake, and a lot of people feel that the president has not managed this issue correctly on foreign policy grounds, and now you've got the constitutional issues themselves.
Nick, I'm also curious. We mentioned Colonel Alex Vindman, former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, apolitical figures who have had long careers and served Republican and Democratic presidents. How much damage has been done to public service through this whole process? And also, what are you hearing from young up-and-coming diplomats over at Harvard?
Well, there's no question that this has been a difficult time to be in the career military, the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, because President Trump for 3 years now has launched a campaign against what he calls the swamp. But in an interesting sort of way, I think when those five career ambassadors and diplomats testified, I think a lot of Americans saw people that were nonpartisan, who were incredibly impressive. They were smart. And I think actually it's made a lot of people recognize we have good people representing us in Washington, D.C., and there is a such a thing as nonpartisanship. Not everybody is taking sides in the Washington battles. At Harvard, at other universities across the United States, we are trying to convince – I'm certainly trying to convince my students – consider public service.
Are they skeptical?
Some of them are. I mean, a lot of students tend to be liberal these days, particularly at my institution, and so they may not want to serve in the Trump administration. I say to them, you've got to serve the country. You've got to serve President Trump as well as future presidents. We desperately need young people to make that choice.
Finally, let's go back to your time as ambassador in Greece, Nick. That was during the Clinton impeachment trials, he said. How did the U.S. manage to keep moving diplomacy forward when all the attention was on the Senate trial?
It was difficult. If you can remember back to January 1999, the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton was the biggest news in the world, but there were real things happening. The Serb government was trying to annihilate a million Kosovar Albanians. That led us, right, a couple of months after impeachment, to block the Serbs and to go to war against them. Al-Qaeda had just struck in August 1998 at our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, killing, I think, nearly 500 people. President Clinton had struck back against them. The world has to go on. And I think it's very important that the American government, that the Trump administration obviously keep focused on the business at hand while this extraordinary, only third in the history of the United States impeachment trial commences.
Nicholas Burns, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Marco.
More on the impeachment story later this hour. A mysterious virus has triggered a pneumonia outbreak in Asia. Health experts are still struggling to understand exactly what the virus is and where it comes from. Chinese authorities confirmed today that the illness can be passed from person to person. That makes containing the virus a challenge, even more so with the start of the Chinese New Year holiday. Hundreds of millions of people across Asia are on the move this week. Tarek Yasharevich is with the World Health Organization in Geneva.
What we can really do right now is basically say to countries, be ready for this new coronavirus, have tools to quickly identify people who may have been infected. We need to be able to treat people who are sick.
So far, China has not put any travel restrictions in place, but experts find this new virus alarming because of its genetic links to SARS, or severe acute respiratory syndrome. It killed more than 750 people around the world in the early 2000s. This new virus has killed three people in Wuhan, the city in China where it was first reported, and it's now spread beyond China's borders. There are cases in South Korea, Japan, and Thailand. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the story from Bangkok.
Yeah, Marco, there's two things I think public health officials would really like to understand. This is in the SARS family of viruses, right? So that means it has SARS-like symptoms. It's going to give you pneumonia, and we know that if you catch it, it's quite bad. However, what they would really like to know is, how exactly did it start? Did it transfer from some wild, non-domesticated animal in this market? If you remember SARS, that came from a civet cat or a bat. They weren't quite sure. There's a Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, MERS. That's a SARS-like virus that came from camels. So what did this one come from? They don't know yet.
So what are you hearing about this virus in Thailand right now?
If you turn on the TV news in Thailand, you're very likely to hear a news announcer say something like this. And what she's saying is, this is the guidance from health officials. We want Thailand's people to feel confident there's no epidemic of this coronavirus. If you have to travel to risky places, please be careful. And one way to stay safe is to avoid markets selling live animals. And she also says, if you have any breathing symptoms, fever or cough, and you've been in these risky situations, go see a doctor immediately.
Why are medical experts focused on Thailand right now?
There are something like 40 million tourists that come to Thailand every year, and about a fourth of those are Chinese. So Some people bring their families here for Chinese New Year, which is going to kick off coming up close to the weekend. You have a lot of people coming from not just China, but the affected area, Wuhan.
Well, exactly. I see there is one case each in Thailand, in Japan, and South Korea. And apparently each of those cases originated with people traveling from Wuhan.
That's correct. And now in China, they're starting to see cases from cities that are quite far from Wuhan, such as Beijing. And so this is it's flu season anyway. Imagine you're experts and you're just trying to scan everybody going through the airport. You're going to have to be pulling a lot of people out that just have the flu, and it's going to take a lot of time to figure out if they have this mysterious virus or they just have the flu. So it's a huge burden for officials.
And that is the protocol right now at the airport in Bangkok, correct? They're checking people flying in for fever?
Yep. If you show up at the airport or the airports in Thailand, you're going to walk past this clunky thermal imaging device, and there'll be someone on the other side seeing whether or not your temperature is abnormally high. It's a big sign that says infrared thermoscan. If you're running a fever, you're going to get pulled aside, especially if you're coming from China. And if they're suspicious that you might have it, you'll get quarantined at the airport in this tiny room and visited by specialists in biohazard suits. We know this because Thailand officials invited the media to come look at their quarantine room through a closed-circuit camera so you could actually see the poor woman from China who is suspected of having this disease. And, you know, you're stuck in a tiny room at the airport until they can get you to the infectious diseases clinic and really check you out.
As experts still try to kind of get to the bottom of what this virus is, what is the next step for them as they try to figure out what's going on? And if it is a SARS connection is established, what should the region and the world be prepared for?
Well, I think the question they really want to know is how easy does it spread, and is this thing going to mutate and start spreading more rapidly? That's the number one concern right now. I have to say, so far, the reaction from public health officials both in China, Korea, Thailand, Japan, these are the countries that have seen cases so far. They seem to be very well prepared, but these diseases can often move faster than officials can react to them.
The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks as always, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
Russia has had a troubling history with bombings, and right now a spate of bomb threats is creating havoc in Moscow. Even though they've all turned out to be hoaxes, it's been a massive disruption for people in the Russian capital. Directly or indirectly, more than a million Russians have been caught up in this string of bomb scares on public places. Vitaly Shevchenko watches Russian media for the BBC.
It's been almost 2 months, actually, since this latest wave of bomb hoaxes started. It seems to have reached a new high today. Official accounts of what's going on are scarce, but the media say that all of the Moscow metro stations, all of Moscow's hospitals, supermarkets belonging to two major chains, more than 100 schools, 20 shopping centres and many courts were being checked by the police, and some have been evacuated. The problem is nobody knows what's behind it. Nobody knows who's coordinating it all.
Police are responding to the threats by evacuating locations that have been specified as targets or by showing up in force with sniffer dogs. Authorities are not saying much publicly or in any of the Kremlin-controlled news outlets, and that is just adding to the confusion. So how do Russians know what's really happening with all the bomb-related news?
Well, first, when I was there last winter, it happened to me. I got stuck on the metro in Moscow. Also, if we don't see it on official media, we go to social media and there's an abundance of reports about, oh, I went to the shop and got evacuated, or my school's been evacuated. It's hugely disruptive when people are complaining.
Also complaining, editors at the independent newspaper Novaya Gazeta. They published an open letter to the Russian security service with a headline that reads, "Why are you keeping silence?" The editorial argues that the bomb evacuations are part of a plan to, quote, destabilize the social and political situation in Russia, and it calls on authorities to put an end to, quote, telephone terrorism. The 2020 presidential election is still about 10 months away, but we've already been talking an awful lot about health care. Democrats have put forward a number of proposals to lower healthcare costs. Unlike a lot of places around the world, in the U.S., when you get sick, it can cost you a fortune. But actually, it's not just when you get sick. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
Having kids is super expensive. You've got food, clothes, soccer camp. Let's not even get into paying for college. But it turns out the cost of having children start even before all that. Giving birth in America is expensive. New research out of the University of Michigan finds the average cost for having a baby is around $4,500.
Out-of-pocket costs for childbirth in the United States are orders of magnitude higher than in other countries.
That's Michelle Moniz. She's a practicing OBGYN and the report's lead author.
We're talking about out-of-pocket costs that are in the thousands, and these are for women with health insurance coverage.
That's right, $4,500 with health insurance. Moniz says high deductible insurance plans are to blame. And there's another problem. She says high costs can deter pregnant women from getting the care that they need.
I regrettably sometimes see patients deciding not to get a lab or an imaging study or other healthcare services that we recommend for them because of their concern about costs.
What's more is that in the U.S., giving birth is not only expensive, the outcomes are bad. The number of women who die during childbirth in the U.S. is high compared to other wealthy nations. This is called the maternal mortality rate. I asked Moniz which country she thought had better systems, and she named one right away, Finland. Finland has one of the lowest maternal mortality rates in the world, and giving birth there is cheap. Professor Mika Yisler is at the National Institute for Health and Welfare in Helsinki. He says the current policy goes back to the 1930s and 40s.
80 years ago, we were very poor and people were living in the countryside without midwives, giving birth home without help. And then the government realized that this is not good.
Finland decided to do something drastic, provide free access to prenatal care. They also rolled out something called the baby box for new moms. It's full of clothes, blankets, diapers, stuff a new parent might need. Every expecting family gets one, even today, for free. Yisler says lowering the costs that come with having a baby make a huge difference.
When it was free for all, 99% of the women started to use it. And at the same time, the mortality rate for the mothers and the children decreased very rapidly.
Costs for delivering a baby are low, too. In fact, in Finland, which has universal healthcare, the state pays for almost everything. Yisler says a big takeaway from Finland's approach is it's worthwhile to focus policy on pregnant women. And many countries are doing just that. Mardia Dennis is a health systems researcher. She's looked at ways of reducing maternal healthcare costs to patients in Kenya. Dennis found that methods like providing healthcare vouchers to expecting mothers can help improve access to care. But they weren't silver bullet solutions on their own.
Cost is a big factor, but it's not the only factor for women. Quality of care, distance to health facilities, all of these things, culture and beliefs around using certain types of care are all also very important too.
Cost is not the only factor that goes into whether a new mom and baby will be safe and healthy. But one thing seems to be clear. When it comes to having a baby in the U.S., you don't necessarily get what you pay for. Let's go back to Michelle Moniz.
The high out-of-pocket costs that we're seeing in this study are particularly disheartening because it suggests that we aren't getting a very good return on investment. The bang for our buck is really not there in terms of paying more for worse outcomes.
For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
A caravan of migrants traveling from Central America has been stopped on Mexico's southern border with Guatemala. This is the first time this has happened since the U.S. signed international agreements with neighboring countries to stop migrants from reaching the U.S. The group of migrants has been held up for days in Guatemala at this point, with the Mexican National Guard facing them down on the other side of the border. The World's Jorge Valencia has been reporting on migration from Central America. He joins me in our Boston studio. Jorge, what exactly is happening today?
Well, Marco, what we're having is hundreds of people camped out in two different entry points, many kilometers apart, on the border between Guatemala and Mexico. And many of them are waiting in 90-degree weather on bridges for Mexican authorities to let them pass. And Mexican authorities are very assertively saying to most of them, you will not enter. And so I just want you to hear what it sounds like of these people camped out at the border today. It's a little bit hard to make out, but this man with the megaphone, what he's saying is, they're not going to let us in through the bridge, so let's all just go down to the river and cross down there. And this is a clip from the news website Animal Político.
It's pretty dramatic, and it sounds like some people are really not happy. Who's exactly in this caravan, and why are they doing this in such large numbers?
Most of the people who come in these caravans are from Central America, and the country right now that is the worst off is Honduras. And the people are fleeing poverty, so there's lack of economic opportunity. They are fleeing persecution from organized crime and also persecution from their own government. People on the streets that I've spoken to in Honduras say that their government is rampantly corrupt. Our colleagues from the BBC spoke just a few days ago with Carla Gallo, who is a woman who is a part of this caravan and is fleeing from Honduras.
En nuestro país puede matarse trabajando y no puede conseguir nada.
So Gallo is saying that in Honduras, a lot of people work themselves to the ground, but that the wages are so low and the cost of living is so high that they can barely even afford to eat.
Apenas alcanza para comer.
This is not the first time, of course, that a large group of people has tried to migrate to the United States. Last year, thousands migrated from Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border. How does this migration compare?
This has been happening for many years, and what changed was that it got the attention of President Trump. He probably saw it on television, got his attention. He put it on the agenda, and he put it on the White House's agenda with relations with Mexico and with Central America. So the U.S. has really influenced these countries' foreign policy. And now, in effect, what we have is instead of having many people at the U.S. border petitioning for asylum, then they were in Mexico, and now they're in Guatemala, because now Mexico themselves is being proactive about not even allowing them to enter Mexico so that eventually they won't reach the U.S.
So, Jorge, does it seem like this is going to stop people in the long term from migrating to the U.S.? I mean, does it seem like the Trump administration is succeeding with this demand on Mexico to keep migrants out of its territory?
Certainly, it seems that if one were to ask Trump immigration officials, they would say that they are being very successful. And at the very least, there are more than 50,000 people waiting in Mexico for asylum hearings in the United States. So viewed that way, it is successful. But I also wanted to get the perspective from Central America. So I called up Connor Walsh. He heads Catholic Relief Services in Honduras. And a lot of the work that he does is geared toward trying to keep people from leaving Honduras. And he says that really in the past year and a half that we have been seeing this as a big story, the conditions really haven't changed.
The situation they're fleeing is the same as it was a year and a half ago. And it's an act of desperation. So they're looking for a better future, but they're also escaping from intolerable conditions here in Honduras.
So I think that the jury's still out about how successful this will be, but it seems that there will continue to be at least some people who are desperate enough to continue trying to reach the U.S.
The World's Jorge Valencia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
American students are helping to fuel an online marketplace where they pay writers in Kenya to do their homework for them.
So you have to make sure that he gets an A so that in future he will refer his friends to you.
The global industry of homework cheating, that's still ahead here on The World. The Senate impeachment trial gets underway tomorrow. President Donald Trump's legal team issued a brief today calling the impeachment proceedings in Congress, quote, a dangerous perversion of the Constitution that the Senate should swiftly and roundly condemn, end quote. Trump faces charges of abusing power and obstructing Congress. His lawyers do not deny the key facts of what happened with the withholding of aid to Ukraine and so on. Instead, his lawyers argue he broke no laws and was acting entirely within his powers. Jonathan Turley is a professor at the Law School of George Washington University. He testified before the House last month, and he urged Congress not to rush to impeach. Earlier today, I asked Turley if he thought Trump's legal strategy was smart.
It's a Trump defense. You know, the defense looks very much like the man accused. If you boil down their response, it comes down to it was perfect. You know, the president has argued that the call was perfect. His actions were perfect. Every way this played out was perfect. And obviously, many of us disagree with that. I disagreed with it in my testimony. I don't think this call was perfect. I think there was a great number of problems with it. But of course, that's not the standard. It isn't a choice between perfect and impeachable. There's much stronger defenses that can be made if they recognize that the president really committed an inappropriate act in raising the Bidens in that call. That doesn't mean it's impeachable. But the president views this as a moment really sort of made for television. You know, he's going to maintain this consistent defense that everything was perfect and what they're doing is pure politics. And that's going to put some of the Republican senators in a bind. Because many of those senators do not believe the call was perfect. They do have serious concerns about what occurred. They just don't necessarily agree that it's impeachable.
How would you explain that to, say, Trump supporters who say, well, if there was no crime, then why should he be going through this trial?
Well, there's both a historical and practical reason. Historically, high crimes and misdemeanors in England and the United States were not confined to crimes. And indeed, even some of the framers like James Madison referred to things like maladministration as being relevant to impeachment. But also practically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, if you think about all the things a president can do that would not necessarily be in the criminal code, you sort of realize why this would be a terrible idea. You know, that if the president, you know, demanded Ukraine investigate his political opponents, let's say he wanted Elizabeth Warren's family investigated for no reason at all, presumably most citizens would view that as an impeachable offense. So it goes too far, but it also has very little basis, I think, in history and the language of the Constitution. So that's going to create a problem again for some of these moderate Republican senators. These are members who are not likely keen on the idea of creating new law here, of confining impeachment just to things you can find in the criminal code. So in some ways, this is coming down to sort of a muscle play. You know, that the Trump defense is telling the Republican senators, we expect your vote. And the defense is, this was perfect. And also, you can't impeach a president unless you have a crime.
So I'm thinking a lot of this and what's going to come out of this trial will depend on those moderate Republicans. What are you expecting, Professor, to happen at the end of this trial?
Well, I think that there is currently support by four senators to have witnesses. I'm not too sure how that will play out. But once you do cross the Rubicon, you're looking at a much longer trial.
I mean, most predictions suggest Trump will survive the Senate. Do you think the introduction of witnesses could change the outcome?
I do. I think witnesses are an unpredictable element. A good example is Clinton. You know, the Democrats lost in trying to block a deposition with Monica Lewinsky, but then they won in blocking her from live testimony. Well, last year, Monica Lewinsky came out and said that Bill Clinton called her after she was named as a witness, talked about her testimony, encouraged her to sign a false affidavit. Mm. If she had said that on the floor of the Senate, it would have been a game changer.
Right.
So these witnesses can be live torpedoes in the water, and they can hit anywhere.
Jonathan Turley, professor at the Law School of George Washington University, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The trial in the Senate might go on for several weeks. If you're taking a civics class right now, that could mean lots of extra homework, which is what this next story is about, one part of the global homework industry. Yes, it is a thing. We're talking essentially cheaters for hire. Students from the U.S. and elsewhere are going online to hire people abroad to do their homework for them. It's big business in Kenya. The world's Halima Gikandi has that story.
When I met Philemon, it was 5 p.m. in Nairobi, Kenya. He had just gotten off work. He's a full-time science researcher. The sun was setting and people were rushing to get home. But Philemon was just beginning his second job. He turned on his phone to show me.
So you just bid. Every minute questions are being posted, so you just place bids. You can even place like 50 to 100 bids. Out of that, you can get nothing, or you get three, or you get one.
Philemon is bidding on homework assignments from students across the world. He's part of the global industry of contract cheating. That's why he didn't want me to use his full name. Basically, he gets paid to do homework assignments from high school and college students. Of course, cheating in school has been around forever. But in recent years, cheating has become increasingly more digital and more global. This is how it works. A student from the U.S. can go online and outsource their homework. The people who do it are euphemistically called academic writers. You can find them on dozens of websites that advertise various services, like tutoring. But writers like Philemon in Kenya use the websites to connect with student clients looking to cheat.
My clients have been coming from various regions in the world I have worked for a client in Australia, also in the US, Kenya, very rare.
Thomas Lancaster studies the contract cheating industry at Imperial College London. About a decade ago, he says he noticed students commissioning completely original homework assignments, assignments that couldn't be detected by anti-plagiarism software.
I found one of my students who was putting their own assignment for my assignment up for tender on an internet site. So people were bidding different amounts of money to complete that computer programming assignment.
Lancaster reckons the global homework industry is worth more than $1 billion.
If we look at where writers are based, Kenya is the top of the list, and that they're incredibly qualified people in Kenya, very high levels of English, very able to write essays quickly, and when they want to a higher standard.
Philemon, the academic writer from Nairobi, started contract cheating in 2016. He was a college student looking to earn some extra cash. He bought himself a laptop and started learning American academic reference styles. One master's degree and a full-time job later, Philemon is still at it. He says he can make up to $1,000 a month, as long as he gets good grades for his clients.
So you have to make sure that he gets an A, so that in future he will refer his or her friends to you.
Philemon is sort of a contract cheating entrepreneur. He paid $800 for an account on a website that helps him connect with students abroad. Then he hires subcontractors to do the homework for him and takes a cut. But as the saying goes, more money, more problems. Finding reliable workers isn't always easy. The day we talked, Philemon's account had been suspended because one of his subcontractors couldn't complete an assignment on time.
I needed someone who is cheap, who could do it at a cheaper cost. I found a person who could do it, but then he let me down. He found it too complex.
This is one way that things can go wrong. But for most academic writers or contract cheaters, their problem is with the websites they use to connect with clients. Charles has been in the industry for more than 10 years. He says that if a student pays $40 per page for an essay, the writer might only get six.
So the contracting industry takes the elephant share of the money.
Higher education institutions around the world have tried to take on this issue of contract cheating. In the UK, universities have urged PayPal and Google to block payments and advertisements from contract cheating websites. Australia is also considering new legislation to crack down on contract cheating. In the U.S., more than a dozen states have laws against contract cheating. But the legislation hasn't slowed down the industry. Students are still cheating. Professor Christian Moriarty teaches ethics and law at St. Petersburg College in Florida. He gave me an example of when he caught one of his own undergraduate students cheating in his ethics class.
I was highly suspicious, and she came. I invited her to my office, and I just asked plainly, "Did you write this?" And she said no.
Moriarty says that when he asked his student why she cheated, he realized she didn't know how to study or manage her time. That's why legislation against contract cheating is only one part of the solution. Moriarty says that universities also need to make sure students understand what their education is worth.
The number one argument they respond to more than anything else is that if our institution becomes known for tolerating cheating, that students can get away with cheating here, what is the value of your degree at that point? Is that students want their degrees and their education to be seen as valuable?
For academic writers in Kenya, like Charles and Philemon, helping students cheat is a way to make money. But they both told me that they do value education and are hoping, one day, to study abroad. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Isabel dos Santos, the daughter of Angola's former president, is a multi-billionaire. She's said to be Africa's richest woman. We're just now starting to learn how she accumulated those billions. Newly leaked documents suggest dos Santos made her fortune through corruption by profiting from land, oil, diamonds, and telecommunications all through her father's connections. Along the way, she may have engaged in criminal activity. That's according to the BBC's Andrew Harding in Johannesburg. He's looked through the newly leaked documents. Harding also sat down with Isabel dos Santos to hear her side of the story.
Well, these documents give a flavor of the close relationship that Isabel dos Santos had with state companies that either supported, underwrote, or in some cases where her father, as president, signed a decree, enabled her to get what it's widely alleged, were unfair access to enormous wealth that she very quickly, for instance, managed with no investment on her side or her husband's side to get a 50% stake in a Swiss diamond company that never made any money. Now, what happened last month was that Angolan investigators had already started digging into some of these allegations, and they, as a result of their concerns, froze her assets in Angola. Then came this leak of documents, which has really added detail to the extraordinarily complex web of international shell companies, for instance, in parts of the world where certainly financial investigators say oversight is poor, and it's the kind of behavior that would normally raise alarms in banks and so on.
This seems to go beyond just leveraging her father's connections. Do any of her activities amount to criminal acts?
Certainly there are concerns, for instance, about the payment of millions of dollars in invoices from the state oil company, which at the time Isabel dos Santos ran, to a company that she had close links to in the hours before, during, and after she was being removed from that job. That's a specific example that has raised real concerns.
And now Isabel dos Santos has denied these allegations, and she spoke with you about that, Andrew. She's called this investigation a politically motivated witch hunt. Here's a clip from your interview with her.
Look, I regret that Angola has chosen this path. I think that we all stand a lot to lose. Now, when you look at my track record and you see the work I have done and you look at all the companies I've built, most certainly my companies are commercial companies. You know, if you tell me, is there anything wrong for an Angolan person to have a business venture with a state company? I think there's nothing wrong.
Yes, but Angolan authorities have Dos Santos under a criminal investigation. They've frozen her assets in Angola, as you said, Andrew. Do you expect she'll find herself in the dock in a courtroom, or is she too powerful for a fairly weak criminal justice system in Angola?
It's a difficult question. I think that the key thing is that she does not plan to return to Angola. She made that very clear to me. She said, first of all, she wouldn't get a fair trial. But secondly, and as importantly, she said that her security and that of her family were at risk. She said the last time she was back there a few years ago, the intelligence services, the security services had basically followed her around. She said there was a pattern of abuse of what she feels are politically targeted individuals. She also says her brother-in-law, for instance, who is on trial for corruption in the country, has been harshly, unfairly treated by the authorities there.
Right. I mean, Dos Santos argues she's being penalized because her father was president of Angola. How do you see the role of Angola's current president, João Lourenço, in all of this? Because he seems determined to go after corruption, and specifically the Dos Santos family. Is he as corruption-free himself as he makes himself out to be?
I think it's a lot murkier than it looks. This is not some new broom, new president coming in and saying, we are going to transform Angola and we are going after all corruption. I think there is an element of politics in this. He sees Isabel dos Santos, a woman who is now talking openly in vague terms, but talking about possibly running for the presidency herself. He sees her and her family still as a threat, and no doubt it is useful for him if he can neutralize her through these corruption investigations.
The BBC's Andrew Harding in Johannesburg telling us about new documents that show how Isabel dos Santos, the daughter of Angola's former president and widely believed to be Africa's richest woman, how she accumulated her billions. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we've discussed today, Donald Trump's impeachment trial gets underway in the Senate tomorrow afternoon. Carrie Cordero is a lawyer who served at the Department of Justice and in the office of the Director of National Intelligence. As a national security expert, Cordero gave me her take on where things stand on the eve of the trial.
There's a lot that we don't know yet. We don't know whether there will be witnesses. We don't know how many days the trial will take. We don't even know how long it will go each day. What we can hope for is that the senators will keep an open mind and approach their job with a seriousness of purpose.
And what is at stake with this trial in the Senate?
The stakes for the trial are high from the president in a theoretical matter, in that all of the information gathered in the House impeachment proceedings will now be presented as evidence for a second time for the American public to hear. So there's another opportunity now for the public to hear all of the facts that were gathered, including the president's actions to pressure the president of Ukraine to announce an investigation into his political opponent, Joe Biden. So the stakes are high from that perspective, although indications from sitting senators is that there likely is not enough votes to actually remove the president from office.
So both teams presented legal briefs over the weekend. President Trump's lawyers did not deny the core facts of what had happened with the withholding of aid to Ukraine, etc. His lawyers argued he broke no laws and was acting entirely appropriately and within his powers. How do they actually square that circle?
Well, we haven't seen the full brief from the president's team yet. We've seen a lengthy brief from the House managers, and we've seen a summary response of 6 or 7 pages from the president's team. But in essence, what they have argued in their short response, and what I expect them to argue, is that the articles of impeachment are invalid because they did not allege an actual crime. My view is that that is not required to meet the standard of impeachment. And in their short response, they also argued that the interactions the president had with the president of Ukraine were legitimate exercises of his foreign policy authorities. There's some observers who think the obstruction of Congress charge is the most significant charge that pertains to the president's unwillingness to provide witnesses, particularly those who still are in the government. He also directed former government employees, for example, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, not to testify. And he directed government agencies like the State Department not to provide documents. So that affects whether future Congresses will be able to get information from the executive branch or from the president.
Nancy Pelosi keeps saying the republic is on the line. Do you think that's overly dramatic, or do you think she has a point?
I think the speaker has a point from the perspective of the allegations against the president are very serious. They're alleging that he abused his national security and defense authorities in order to have political personal gain. And so the question for the senators, and where there is a historical precedent, is whether by not removing him from office, they are going to say that that's all right, that that type of behavior is acceptable. So do I think we are in a constitutional crisis? No, I think the Constitution is working as designed. But am I concerned about the precedent that will be set for the behavior the president engaged in? Yes.
Carrie Cordero was an attorney at the Department of Justice. She's now with the Center for a New American Security. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
We leave you today in the town of Tabasco, Mexico, where a housing project could stretch your understanding of what 3D printing is all about. The nonprofit News Story is building the world's first community of 3D printed houses. Each home is 500 square feet with all the amenities you'd expect in a modern house. News Story is helping plan a neighborhood with 50 of these homes. So far, 4 have been built, or rather printed. Brett Hagler is behind the project. He told me what it means to print a house.
It's a proprietary cement mix that's made by our partner Icon. It kind of looks like soft serve ice cream oozing out of a nozzle, and it is layering the interior and the exterior walls of a house. And so it starts at the very bottom, and it'll do a layer of about 1 to 2 inches, and then we'll layer the home all the way until the very top, until you can put a roof on, usually over 100 layers to get to the top. And it took about 24 hours of printing time. This is kind of the slowest it's ever going to be. And that's the promise with robotic construction, is that it's only going to get faster and higher quality over time.
Is it expensive to make one of these homes?
Absolutely not. It's still super early into the process, so we're not sharing an exact price, but we've designed these homes to be for families that are living in extreme poverty, and they will be as affordable as we can possibly make them.
Why in Tabasco?
So we had worked there in the past in that state. Their government was very supportive of the project. And the families that we serve and we want to partner with, a lot of them live in seismic areas. And we wanted to design the material and the foundation to withstand an earthquake. We believe very confidently that these will be the strongest homes in the whole town.
How did you select the families who would live in these homes?
So we rely on our excellent local partner, Echele Tu Casa, and then we have a standard procedure that is trying to vet, you know, why are families in the situation they're in? What is their income? And, you know, we work with families that are basically the most vulnerable families in the area.
I think about other people in Mexico in need of shelter, the immigrants from like Honduras and Guatemala. Is that also in the back of your mind as you think about the scope of this project?
Unfortunately, not really, because what we do is focus on creating communities that are built to last. When families move in, it's where we hope they will be for decades to come, generational impact.
Well, good luck. Brett Hagler, the CEO of New Story, which is the housing nonprofit leading a project printing a 3D community in Tabasco, Mexico. Thanks for being here, Brett.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Brett told me New Story does hope to expand the project to other cities in Mexico and further across Latin America. Take a virtual tour of these 3D printed homes. We've got video on our Instagram. We are at PRI The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.